and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Special Counsel Robert Mueller has told the federal courts that he is no longer obliged to maintain the plea agreement with Paul Manafort. Mueller asserts that Manafort has violated the agreement by lying to the special counsel. Today, there are headlines proclaiming this to be true because his legal team spoke with President Trump's, but the two legal teams have a defense agreement authorizing this. It's a common communication tool that the two parties have had in place for a long time. Next, Guardian reporter Luke Harding made news yesterday when he reported from Quito, Ecuador, that Paul Manafort had met three times with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Manafort and Assange both denied the report, and The Guardian has begun editing and softening the article's original language. But who is Luke Harding, and why would he report something that just simply isn't true? Then, President Trump gave an interview to The Washington Post yesterday in which he threatened to cancel a meeting with Vladimir Putin and urged European countries to maintain a hostile posture toward Russia. Trump also railed against the Federal Reserve's chairman, Jerome Powell, and the interest rate policies that the Fed has been pursuing. And then, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has named former Wall Street Journal editorial writer Mary Kissel as his new senior policy advisor for strategic messaging. It's not unusual that a journalist would enter the State Department, and it actually happens all the time. But in 2016, Kissel went on MSNBC's Morning Joe to call Donald Trump, quote, frighteningly ignorant, unquote, and to say that he had, quote, no principles and no policies, unquote. Trump responded by tweeting that Kissel was a major loser, exclamation point. And finally, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said yesterday that the UK Integrity Initiative is a British government-sponsored front organization aimed at defaming the Russian government. The UK Integrity Initiative purported to be an independent watchdog organization until hackers from the group Anonymous found documents proving that it was created by British intelligence. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Paul Manafort and the special counsel. Special counsel Robert Mueller has told the federal court that he is no longer obliged to maintain a plea agreement with Paul Manafort. Mueller asserts that Manafort has violated that agreement by lying to the special counsel. And today there are headlines proclaiming this to be true because his legal team spoke with President Trump's legal team. But those two teams have a defense agreement authorizing contact. It's a common communication tool that the two parties have had in place for the long term. We're joined from Washington by attorney Bruce Fine. He is a noted constitutional law scholar and a former assistant deputy attorney general of the United States. Bruce, welcome back.
Thank you, John.
Bruce, I can't help but to think that on the one hand, this is a really important development. And on the other hand, that it's really a chess move in this strategic competition between the special counsel and the White House, with Manafort being one of the pawns. Can you explain to us what the importance is of the news of the last day or so on this issue?
I think, John, perhaps for the audience, some background is necessary. You know, what is a common defense agreement? And that requires an understanding of the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. Ordinarily, the attorney-client privilege protects any communication that a client gives in secret with shares with the attorney for purposes of mounting a defense. But the attorney-client privilege is waived if that information is communicated to a third party. So the idea would be, absent an agreement of a joint defense, if that communication to the attorney was also shared with the attorney for someone else, that would waive the privilege. So you develop the joint defense arrangement in order to protect the client's, the attorney-client privilege and the Fifth Amendment privilege in sharing information to amount a defense. Now, in this particular case, it's obvious, it seems, that Mr. Manafort was sharing information, not necessarily because he thought that his defense would be helped insofar as he could help Mr. Trump or any other potential defendant. But in my judgment, there's nothing illegal about a witness sharing whatever he told prosecutors to the whole world, if you want us to do that. But because I believe that Mr. Manafort thinks his only real option for saving his life, as it was before, was a pardon from Trump. And this is a way in which he can share information that would enable Mr. Trump's lawyers to see what kind of evidentiary paths Mr. Mueller is pursuing and perhaps take actions, whether you call it evasion or adaptation of where he thought things were going or something of that sort. Because otherwise, it's hard to imagine what's in it for Manafort. You know, he's already destroyed.
Bruce Fein is our guest. Bruce, the Atlantic website, Atlantic.com, ran a story 2 months ago, or more than 2 months ago, September 13th, 2018, how Trump and Manafort are helping each other in the Russia investigation. The two have a joint defense agreement which allows their legal teams to share information and could help the president's former campaign chairman angle for a pardon. This is not a new news item, even though when you look at the mainstream media right now, they're like, wow, Manafort is talking to Trump's legal team. This has been out in the open. This is not
yes.
a secret.
No, this is old news.
So what's going on right now? And Robert Mueller obviously knew this to be the case. Why is Mueller switching?
Well, I think the time sequence here is critical. You would not expect an arrangement like that to persist after Mr. Manafort negotiates a plea deal with Mueller, and knowing that the sentence that would ultimately be recommended by Mueller would turn in part on his cooperation and coming forth with evidence trying to help Mueller's team. Because Mueller's recommendation, although not conclusive on a judge, will be very important. So it's one thing to have a joint cooperation agreement before you're convicted, before your sentence is going to turn on how well you're able to satisfy the needs of the prosecutor. Another, why would you continue the joint cooperation agreement? Because it's obvious the prosecutor is not going to be happy that you're spilling all of your information with somebody else who could be a potential defendant. So that's what makes it newsworthy, that it would persist past the phase of conviction, past the phase of a plea agreement, past the phase where there was a cooperation purportedly continuing between, at least at that point, Mr. Manafort and Mr. Mueller.
Bruce, let's say that Paul Manafort is given a presidential pardon. That wipes out his conviction in the federal district of the District of Columbia and what would likely be a conviction in the Eastern District of Virginia. Are there state charges that he could then face? Could he still end up in prison even if he gets a presidential pardon?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think there's some curlicues on it. First, the pardon would not shield Mr. Manafort from being called to testify under oath with regard to a whole host of things. He can't. And if he commits perjury again in being called as a witness, then that's something beyond the scope of the current pardons that could be conceived. Secondly, you would have to ask, yes, it's true that the pardon power only extends to federal crimes, not state crimes. It's not clear to me if there was some state violation, perhaps involving a banking law. Many of these things happened years ago, and whether at this time, in 2018, there may be a statute of limitations issue. Typically, it's 5 years in criminal cases, certainly of the type that we're talking about. But, for example, is pleading, you know, violating federal income tax laws? Well, maybe he violated the state income tax laws. I don't know. I don't know where his residence was at the time. Certainly, the plea to a violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act, there isn't any comparable state provision, so it's not immediately clear how that would result in a state violation. But perhaps with regard to banking laws, you know, there's dual federal jurisdiction and state jurisdiction over banks. And it's possible that some of his crimes that involve defrauding banks and misrepresenting his balance sheet could fall into a state jurisdiction. But then you'd have to ask, because attorneys general are very political figures, is it a state that's run by a Republican attorney general or a Democrat one, to see whether they're likely to take that up. But in a constitutional sense, John, no, the pardon power cannot extend to state crimes. We just don't know enough of the facts to know whether Manafort would be vulnerable on that score at this stage in 2018.
Bruce Fein, I know you don't know, it's speculative, but do you believe, based on your observations in the media at least, that Mueller believes that Manafort would end his joint defense agreement with Trump or with the Trump legal team, and then found out later that he did not, and that, you know, has inspired the anger of Mueller to reject the plea? And secondly, because we're not lawyers, wouldn't it be normal that a prosecutor would sort of insist that that kind of thing be taken care of ahead of time? In other words, to end the joint defense agreement as a criteria for the plea deal in advance? In other words, not finding out later?
I don't know whether or not that this was an oversight. After all, we remember not many a week or so ago in the press, an oversight, the prosecutor in the Eastern District of Virginia yielded information that Julian Assange is under indictment. He didn't intend it. There are a lot of small things that you can overlook because this wouldn't be the most important element here of the equation. So it could have been just an oversight, and I wouldn't necessarily call it sloppy because I don't know what kind of other pressures and things that were underway. But you could certainly say to a defendant, unless you win the joint agreement, I'm not going to accept a plea. That would be a constitutional approach to take. Obviously, I don't think that was done here. I think when they discovered that it was continuing, they became very scrupulous about how truthful he was, and also wanted to send a signal to other defendants who are under similar obligations to cooperate that they better be scrupulous about complying with their obligation or they're going to get hit over the head with a hammer like Manafort did. So there's a deterrent or interorum aspect to this that transcends just the Manafort problem.
Bruce, there's still news out there of sealed indictments. Do you think that signals that we're near the end of this, where they'll be unsealed, or is this thing going to drag on longer?
Well, to my mind, there's no way that this investigation will end until Mr. Trump is deposed by Mueller, whether it's after a court fight or not. He's obviously the most important figure, whether you call him a target or not, of the entire investigation. And, you know, it's like believing you could tie up Watergate with Haldeman and Ehrlichman without examining Nixon. It just wasn't going to happen. So irrespective of what, and I don't think the fact that indictment is sealed or not really signals that whether it's sealed or not is very little to do with whether or not the investigation is likely to be reaching its end. It's just that you would want a prosecutor seals indictments when they think its disclosure would facilitate the ability of the defendant to destroy evidence or evade capture or something like that. It really has nothing to do with whether they're under investigations that are underway. But I do not, my own view is that, say, the investigation will not end until there is a deposition one way or the other, you know, after a court fight with Mr. Trump. I do believe it's going to go to court. I do believe it will end up in the United States Supreme Court. And I believe Mr. Trump will lose. What he does after that, I don't know. But that's at least 6 months to a year away.
Wow. Well, that was the voice of Attorney Bruce Fein. He joined us from Washington. Mr. Fein is a constitutional law scholar and former Assistant Deputy Attorney General of the United States. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Guardian reporter Luke Harding made news yesterday when he reported from Quito, Ecuador, that Paul Manafort had met three times with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London before the 2016 election. Manafort and Assange both denied the report, and The Guardian has begun editing and softening the article's original language. They've now issued a statement. We're going to talk about what that statement actually says about their original story. We want to also talk about who is Luke Harding, the author of the story, and why would he report something that just perhaps simply isn't true. We're joined from Virginia by Joe Loria. He's the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he is the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Joe Loria, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you very much, Brian. Thank you.
Let's first frame what this article stated. Luke Harding is the author. I want to talk about who Luke Harding is, his background. But the article stated almost unequivocally, well, it was unequivocally, that Paul Manafort, who later became Donald Trump's campaign chairman, met three times with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy. Since then, Joe Loria, The Guardian has been, they haven't refuted the story, but they're certainly walking back from important details.
WikiLeaks' reaction immediately upon publication of this story was a tweet that said, "Remember this day when The Guardian permitted a serial fabricator to totally destroy the paper's reputation." They went on to say this would go down in history as bad a fabrication as Stern magazine having published Hitler's diaries, which of course turned out to be a forgery. That was several decades ago. What we have here is not only The Guardian's reputation on the line, but it's Luke Harding's reputation on the line. He wrote a best-selling book called Collusion. There's still no proof of collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. Every indictment that Mueller has come up with has specifically left out any collusion with Americans. And when the announcement of the indictment is made, even Rod Rosenstein and others have made that point, there's no collusion. So this is a desperate reporter, in my opinion. He has his own reputation to save here. Forget about The Guardian's reputation. He needs to come up with something fast. And there are other people who are pretty desperate right now, and I think that's the Mueller investigative team and the Ecuadorian government that wants to get Assange out of the embassy. So this is a combination of these three people who need something to save their positions, or in Ecuador's case, to give a reason to perhaps try to expel him. And there is absolutely no evidence for this in terms of Manafort never having signed the visitor's log. And apparently the visitor's log was made public and his name's not on it. There is no video of him entering or leaving the embassy. That embassy is ringed with CCTV cameras. Certainly he would have been seen. That evidence could have been produced by this Ecuadorian government, given to The Guardian, posted on their website, end of story, proof. It's not there. Harding and Mueller and Ecuador needed something to come up with, and I think they've really put their foot in it this time, Brian. I really do.
Yes. Harding was The Guardian's Russian correspondent from 2007 to 2011. It's worth noting that Harding was accused of plagiarism by Mark Ames and Yasha Levine on the Exile website for publishing an article under his own name that lifted large passages almost verbatim from their work. The Guardian allegedly redacted portions of Harding's article in response to those allegations. That's not a very a good sort of resume point for Luke Harding. Joe Laurie, I want to also talk to you about an interview that Aaron Mate had with Luke Harding. I want to play a short audio clip of it. Now, again, Luke Harding's book is called Collusion, Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Donald Trump Win. Okay, that's an assertive, affirmative statement. That's the title, Collusion, Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Donald Trump Win. The Real News journalist Aaron Mate interviews Luke Harding. This is an 18-second audio clip. By the end of it, you'll see why we think it's important to play.
Really, anyone who knows Russia or has bothered to read books on the Cold War sort of realizes this is precisely what they do. Now, did they do it with Donald Trump? We don't know. Steele thinks they did. Donald Trump will know the answer to that question for sure.
So basically, Joe Lauria, what Aaron Mate is asking Luke Harding to say is, how do you come to the conclusion that there was collusion? And he said, well, the Russians do this, and they may have done it in the 2016 election, and to know if they actually did it, you'd have to ask Donald Trump. That means he actually doesn't have any factual basis for the title, the thesis of his book.
Absolutely not. The guy is a tool of the MI6. I don't think there's any doubt about that. He was expelled from Russia for that very reason. He had some very bizarre incidents there where he claimed that the FSB was coming into his room at night and opening windows. I did somebody try to kill him at the airport by touching him. The guy is really out there. And on The Real News, the real journalist was Aaron Mate on that exchange, without question, not Luke Harding. The guy's reputation is in tatters if anybody wants to look. But, you know, he's full of himself, frankly. He thinks he's a great journalist. He's got the big scoop, and he's got MI6 speaking into his ear. And in this case, down in Ecuador, where he was for this story, apparently the Ecuadorian intelligence also fed him this garbage that he had to take because he needs to save himself because he's out there with that book, Collusion, and there's no evidence of collusion. Couple of years later, he's desperate. The Guardian went along with this. They have turned against Assange. and against Russia in a big way in the last couple of years. And we have got this ridiculous situation now where this story is crumbling, as you pointed out at the beginning, almost by the minute. They're making edits. They're making changes. They finally got the denials from Manafort and Assange into their story. And they're now facing a huge, what could be a very huge lawsuit from WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks just announced that they are, Assange himself personally has ordered WikiLeaks to sue The Guardian. They've set up a GoFundMe page to fund this lawsuit. It's a bad day for The Guardian, and even worse day for Luke Harding, in my opinion.
Yeah, again, what we just heard Luke Harding say in that interview with Aaron Maté from The Real News, when Aaron Maté was just asking him for proof that there was Russian collusion, the title of his book, he said, "Anyone who knows Russia or who has bothered to read books on the Cold War, did they do it with Donald Trump? We don't know. Steele thinks so. So only Donald Trump will know for sure." Meaning Luke Harding doesn't know for sure, in spite of the fact that that, in fact, is the title of his book. Here's what The Guardian has now issued as a statement, Joe Luria. "The story relied on a number of sources. We put these allegations to both Paul Manafort and Julian Assange's representatives prior to publication. Neither responded to deny the visits taking place. We have since updated the story to reflect their denials." Wow. I don't think they're not ditching the story, but that's not much of a defense of the story. And I think it's kind of a disingenuous statement by The Guardian. What do you think?
Well, it sounds like an old journalistic trick where you get the story together and then you need to get the reaction from the side that you're accusing someone of. And then you wait 5 minutes. You've sent them a message. They don't respond. And then you report there was no immediate response, or there was no response from the other side. And now there's been a response, and a furious one, denying this from both Manafort and WikiLeaks.
Besides Luke Harding's own sort of self-interest in saving his career right now and justifying his book, a book that has a title that without the facts to back it up. Besides that, the linking of Assange to Manafort just before Manafort's sentencing, what do you think about the timing issue?
Yeah, it came out the same day or the day after he lost his plea deal, because they said, the FBI has said, or the Justice Department has said, that he's guilty of crimes and lying. And he's in solitary confinement here in Alexandria, where I am. So the timing is also, of course, Mueller's report is going to come out pretty soon. And they've not got the central point of this whole exercise that we've been going through for the last couple of years, which was collusion. There isn't any evidence yet of that. They need to find some. And I wouldn't put it past the Mueller team to fabricate something. And it looks like Luke Harding is a willing partner in that fabrication. As I said, Ecuador has their interest in this. Mueller has their interest in this. Harding has an interest in this. And so does The Guardian. They've been out on a limb as well, publishing his stuff and other stuff, claiming there was this collusion and this anti-Russia stuff that Harding is famous for. You know, the guy, if you read a couple of books, I wonder if he's read a couple of books on Russia. The guy is so way out there that it, unless you're an actual Russiagate believer, and we've talked about this, how this is really a matter of faith rather than evidence, you would laugh at this story, as I hope we're doing here on this interview, because it cannot be taken seriously. They didn't produce the evidence.
The headline of the story originally was "Manafort held secret talks with Assange in Ecuadorian embassy." Then Assange and Paul Manafort denied it. Then the new headline that came out a little bit later was "Manafort held secret talks with Assange in Ecuadorian embassy, comma, sources say." In other words, no longer a definitive conclusion. Here's the third paragraph. The original says, "It is unclear why Manafort wanted to see Assange and what was discussed." The new version is, "It is unclear why Manafort would have wanted to see Assange." In other words, not why he saw Assange, but why he would have, maybe, perhaps, even if he didn't, wanted to see Assange.
What is the reason that he wanted to see it? And all of these meetings took place before he joined the team, or the last one around the time that he joined the Trump team. This whole issue of whether there was some collusion between WikiLeaks and Trump people, including the Roger Stone thing and Randy Credico and all of that, is nonsense. Because even if WikiLeaks told somebody on the campaign, look, we've got these emails, we're going to release them, that doesn't prove any kind of collusion. They just tipped them off that it's coming out. Where did anyone on the Trump team help either the Russians to hack the DNC and the Podesta emails? And where was the transfer from the Russians, if in fact they did it, to WikiLeaks? And what role did anybody on the Trump team play? What role could they have played? How could they have helped in the hacking, if it was a GRU operation, it would have been a need-to-know basis. What would they need anyone in the Trump team to do to help them to hack emails or to transfer them? They wouldn't want their Trump team to know about this if, in fact, this happened. So this is so bizarre to put out there that that Stone or Manafort knew in advance about these emails. Even if they were told, that doesn't prove any guilt in terms of collusion. It's just they were tipped off in advance. I don't see this point at all that's repeatedly made. And again, we have no evidence that happened anyway. And the Manafort meetings took place before the campaign launched, before these leaks took place, or hacks as well, by the way, even if it's just I don't know what to say anymore.
We're going to come back to this story. That was Joe Loria. We were talking to Joe from Virginia. Joe is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry. Joe is also the author of the book, How I Lost, by Hillary Clinton. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
President Trump gave an interview to the Washington Post yesterday in which he threatened to cancel a meeting with Vladimir Putin at the G20 and urged European countries to maintain a hostile posture towards Russia. Trump also railed against the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell and the interest rate policies that the Fed has been pursuing. We're joined from London by Steve Keen. He's the author of Debunking Economics and the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. That's K-E-E-N. And we're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. Steve and Walter, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Good to be here.
Happy to be here.
Well, Donald Trump gave this interview to the Washington Post. He suggested perhaps following the events in the Sea of Azov between Russia and Ukraine, that maybe he would not, in fact, meet with Putin on the sidelines of the G20 meeting in Argentina. But more importantly, I thought in this interview, it shows that Donald Trump is ranting and raving against Europe and against Germany.
Yeah, and Germany, I think Germany is the key point here, because I think, you know, maybe what Trump had in mind when he was talking to the Washington Post and he talked about Germany by name is what he would perceive as, you know, a weak or timid response to the dispute over the Kerch Strait between Ukraine and Russia. But I think underlying all of this, really at the core of a lot of these tensions and criticisms that Trump has of Germany and the government of Angela Merkel, is the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, this pipeline, major pipeline that's under construction that would transport Russian gas to Germany. And it would be much, much cheaper because of just simple geography than purchasing gas from U.S. you know, from U.S. corporations.
Steve Keen, you know, Donald Trump is sort of decried here in Washington, D.C. as being a friend of or even a puppet of Vladimir Putin. Doesn't sound like the way a puppet or a friend would talk, in fact.
No, I mean, I've just found the whole Russian thing quite laughable, as if a few trolls, Russian trolls, managed to change the American election. It was American trolls that managed to do that fundamentally. So, And to see Trump as having any enduring political or personal alignments, I think we can see what he did to Manafort shows that he only aligns with people so long as he sees them as being favourable to his situation. And if he's now regarding American gas as being undercut by Russian, then there goes the common interest with Putin.
And, you know, it's not like this is the first type of tension or first source of tension between Donald Trump and the German government or other European governments because of the trade policies, because of all the tariffs. I mean, this has got to be sort of, you know, have an additive effect in terms of the economic tensions, you know, deteriorating.
Yeah. Again, I think trying to pick any pattern in Trump apart from him seeing what is in his self-interest and what he sees as being America's national interests, you're wasting your time. It's always strange to see people trying to work out what is the strategy behind somebody who can't put a coherent sentence together.
I wonder, Walter, if the U.S. government, and it's not just Trump, are really targeting Germany and the Merkel government, because the Merkel government, along with Macron in France, is suggesting that they don't want to go along with additional sanctions against Russia, which are being demanded. Again, not just by Trump, by the entire neocon establishment against Russia for what happened in the Sea of Azov. Here's the Wall Street Journal. Such sanctions, meaning new sanctions, will work best if implemented in coordination with Europe. New measures will be a tough sell in countries like Italy and Greece. Yet recent months have brought a new awareness of the threat of Russian espionage across Europe, which could concentrate some minds. This is the right-wing editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, although some liberals will echo this. Germany deserves a special mention as Berlin enjoys considerable leverage thanks to the proposed Nord Stream 2 pipeline that would carry natural gas from Russia to the West. Mr. Putin hopes this conduit through the Baltic Sea will tighten his energy grip on Western Europe while allowing him to cut off Ukraine and other Eastern European states from gas transit revenues. What they're basically asking Merkel and the Germans and the others in Western Europe is to commit economic, well, maybe it's not economic suicide, it's certainly shooting oneself in the foot to be able to say, yeah, let's get a more expensive energy source for our country, meaning all of our the prices of all of our goods and the prices our people have to pay will go up.
Yeah, that's right. It's a simple calculation that they have to make, you know, in the energy sector, but also in other sectors of the economy as well. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of business that's done between German corporations and Russian corporations, or German corporations in Russia, or Russians investing in, you know, say the UK or in France or in Germany. You know, there's a much more robust trade back and forth between the countries of the European Union and Russia. And it's because it makes sense because of geography, I think, is a principal factor. And here comes Donald Trump, who, in addition to saying, hey, you have to give us more money so that we can, well, basically, you have to give our weapons contractors more money by boosting your military spending to meet the NATO threshold. You know, you have to change your trade policies or else we're going to put tariffs on you. And now he's also saying, hey, you have to choose the more expensive option when it comes to natural gas.
Steve King, you are an economist. I want to read a paragraph from the Washington Post story about their interview with Trump on other issues and get your comment. In a wide-ranging and sometimes discordant 20-minute interview with the Washington Post, Trump complained at length about Federal Reserve Chair Jerome J. Powell, whom he nominated last year. When asked about the declines on Wall Street and GM's announcement that it was laying off 15% of its workforce, Trump responded by criticizing higher interest rates and other Fed policies, though he insisted that he is not worried about a recession. Quote, I'm doing deals and I'm not being accommodated by the Fed. They're making a mistake because I have a gut, and my gut tells me more sometimes than anybody else's brain can ever tell me. Anyway, your reaction?
Well, I think in some terms he's actually quite right on that front, because if he's being advised by economists who didn't see the financial crisis coming because they don't understand the role of credit in the economy, and there's one thing that Trump does understand, it's the economic power of credit. So what's been happening with the rate rises is the Federal Reserve is putting up rates in complete oblivion of the impact that will have on the level of outstanding debt, because according to their models, the level of private debt has no economic impact. But what it will do, because that's their model, the real world's totally different. As you pump up the interest rates, more and more people are carrying enormous servicing costs, which they can't maintain. Credit growth will stagnate and the economy will go into a recession again. And that's my expectation that'll happen before the re-election campaign starts in 2020. So I do think he's actually quite right that Powell is risking the recovery he's got so far by putting up rates, which will trigger a credit event in a similar way to Roosevelt, following the advice of conventional economists back in 1936-37, triggered a return to 20% unemployment rates after America had got back to 11% after the New Deal. So, yeah, on this one, I would actually this time trust Trump's gut as well, but I don't want to hear his mouth speak.
Steve, what the Fed and most mainstream economists would say in response to that is like, well, look, monetary policy was extremely, extremely in an unprecedented way accommodative as a consequence of the 2008 and 2009 financial crisis. There are negative interest rates, there's quantitative easing, there are all these sorts of unorthodox things that were done. And, you know, now that the economy is growing at a reasonable pace, this is our only opportunity. We have to raise rates. We have to, you know, quote unquote, normalize monetary policy. How would you respond to that?
Well, that's what Japan thought after 1990. And every time they put rates up again, the private sector went into deleveraging again, and they went from what looked like a recovery back into a slump once more. And that's what I pretty much expected to be happening after the financial crisis in 2008, because conventional economists didn't learn that lesson from Japan because they don't understand credit. So If you want to normalize the situation, what you've got to do is reduce the level of private debt in America from roughly 150% to 50% of GDP. If you wiped out the debt equivalent to 100% of GDP, then you'd be normalizing. But they're not even looking at that. So they think they can be normalized by interest rates without worrying about the level of outstanding debt and the level of credit. And they're completely wrong.
Let's go to the last piece of this press interview that Donald Trump did with the Washington Post. Last week, the day after Thanksgiving, the White House issued a climate change report. It was, like many others, devastating in terms of an affirmation that, yes, climate change is happening. It's going to be disastrous for people. It's going to be disastrous for the economy. The president said to the Washington Post, as to whether or not it's man-made and whether or not the effects that you're talking about are there, I don't see it. I mean, it's quite something. Donald Trump, again, following his gut, doesn't really see climate change as a big deal.
Yeah, especially considering that he literally just saw it when he visited California to see the enormous historic wildfires that killed, the death toll might end up topping 100. Yeah, I mean, it's completely outrageous. And, you know, that report, I mean, it is related to economics in addition to the people who fall victim to natural disasters, because the report estimates the enormous astronomical economic cost of climate change as well.
Steve Keen, we'll come back to you perhaps next week after the G20. Donald Trump says maybe, maybe not about a meeting with Vladimir Putin. We'll have to see. Maybe even if they do meet, it doesn't perhaps change much given the overall direction of U.S. policy towards Russia. Anyway, we're joined from London by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics. He's the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/profsteve.keen, and we were also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik news analyst. Stay with us.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has named former Wall Street Journal editorial writer Mary Kissel as his new senior advisor for policy and strategic messaging. It's not unusual that a journalist would enter the State Department at a senior position. It actually happens all the time. But in 2016, Kissel went on MSNBC's Morning Joe to call Donald Trump, quote, frighteningly ignorant, unquote, and to say that he has, quote, no principles and no policies, unquote. Trump responded by tweeting that Kissel was a major loser, exclamation point. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, as well as a columnist for Counterpunch. He's also the author of a major new article in The Nation entitled The Pentagon's Massive Accounting Fraud Exposed. I read this article. It's very important. We're going to talk about it a little bit later in this segment. Dave, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
Dave, let's get this Kissel thing out of the way because I do want to focus on your article. Why in the world would... would Mike Pompeo name this woman, Mary Kissel, to such a senior position when any 16-year-old intern can search Twitter and find in 10 seconds the back and forth between Trump and Kissel?
The only thing that I can think of is that nobody takes Trump seriously in the White House on what he says from day to day. So that could be one answer. I guess the other one would be that, you know, this kind of neocon person, which she is basically taking over the White House. I mean, I wouldn't have called Trump a neocon when he was running for office, but I think his policies are, at this point, pretty much in the neocon playbook on foreign policy.
Well, John, that's an important point.
It is.
You know, there's a lot being made while they called each other names back in 2016. She said he was frighteningly ignorant, talking about the president or the president as he was not yet president. But in fact, there has been a transformation of the Trump administration.
Oh, yes.
On Russia and on Syria and on almost all elements where it's adopted a full-throated neocon political orientation. And Donald Trump called a lot of people names in the past. He's out campaigning for some of them right now, like Ted Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this comes with Donald Trump's approval. Maybe it's not the big deal that the media is making about it.
Maybe you're right. Maybe we're looking into this a little bit too much. You know, it's one thing to say that somebody was a member of the Never Trump movement, because remember, Never Trump meant Never Trump in the fall of 2016. The next thing you know, there are dozens of people who were a part of the Never Trump movement who signed their names onto a full-page ad in the New York Times and the Washington Post saying that they would never under any circumstances work for Donald Trump, and now they're working for Donald Trump. So maybe we're making too much out of this. Maybe Pompeo cleared it with Donald Trump, and this woman apologized and said that Donald Trump's the greatest, you know, leader since Abraham Lincoln. Who knows?
Yeah, he responds really well to just complete fawning praise, you know. So I would think that if somebody sort of swallows their pride and says, I'm really sorry, I really messed up, you're a great guy, you are the best thing on Thanksgiving, you know, then maybe you get accepted again.
Dave Lindorf is our guest. Dave, you just published a major piece in The Nation magazine. It's so important because it's actually something that people have been talking about for years, and the Pentagon has never done anything about it. This is an audit of the Pentagon, the major big four firm of Ernst & Young, as well as other private firms, were brought in to do an audit on the Pentagon. What happened?
It was a complete failure. And I mean that in a way that it is quite appalling because, you know, all these companies spend most of their time reviewing the books every year by law of public companies in the country, you know, Apple and Amazon and all those companies. And sometimes they find things in the financial statements that they get, the documents from the companies that they can't sign off on, and so they will add a comment letter to the books when they finish them. And a comment letter, you know, you see all the numbers and everything, you see the balance sheets and everything, but you get this letter saying, you know, we can't fully agree with the papers because of this, this, and this. And what they couldn't do that at the Pentagon. They could not submit even the financial statements because the numbers were so screwy that instead they're submitting lists of thousands of deficiencies that they say have to be corrected before they can do an actual audit. So this is a real serious fail. And Shanahan, the undersecretary of in charge of this, said, "Yeah, we failed, but we should get credit for having even attempted to audit a $2.7 billion operation."
Trillion.
What he didn't say is that, well, yeah, but for 26 years you've been stonewalling an order by Congress to have auditable books. And every other agency of the federal government has done it.
That's right. That's one of the most important things in your piece. You say, to reiterate, you say here, Deputy Secretary of Defense Patrick Shanahan tried to put the best face on things, telling reporters, quote, "We failed the audit, but we never expected to pass it," unquote. Shanahan suggested that the DOD should get credit for attempting an audit, saying, quote, "It was an audit on a $2.7 trillion organization, so the fact that we did the audit is substantial," unquote. The truth, though, is that the DOD was dragged kicking and screaming to this audit by bipartisan frustration in Congress, and the result, had this been a major corporation, likely would have been a crashed stock. You're exactly right. And this is despite the fact that there are very important movers and shakers on Capitol Hill, not the least of whom is Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, who have been demanding this audit for many years. In fact, you note that in 1990, Congress passed the Chief Financial Officers Act, which required all federal departments and agencies to develop an auditable accounting system. Now, here we are 28 years later, and the Pentagon is just being audited for the first time, and the audit is impossible.
Yeah. To me, this should have been a moonshot headline, you know, moon landing headline at the New York Times. Pentagon fails first audit. It's enormous. It's like half, more than half the U.S. federal budget goes to the defense, and you can't tell how they're really spending the money. So that is an astonishing thing that the American taxpayer, you would think, would be demanding to know about, but it's not even making the front page of the major media.
You make a conclusion here that I think is really important, and I want you to elaborate on it. You say here that the bottom line really is that for decades, DOD's leaders and accountants have been perpetrating a gigantic unconstitutional accounting fraud, deliberately cooking the books to mislead the Congress and drive DOD's budgets ever higher, regardless of military necessity. DOD has literally been making up numbers in its annual financial reports to Congress, representing trillions of dollars worth of seemingly non-existent transactions, knowing that Congress would rely on those misleading reports when deciding how much money to give the Pentagon the following year. That's a crime. That sounds like a major felony to me.
Yeah, it is a crime. And yet, you know, when Enron had its problems, the FBI came pouring in and sealed the books, and, you know, they ended up sending the CFO and CEO to jail. But there's no prosecution of the Pentagon. No one's ever been fired in all those 28 years for what the Pentagon has terms for this. They make up the numbers. They call them plug, which is not an accounting term, but it's common at the Pentagon. Everybody in the Pentagon knows what a plug is. It's when you make up the number and you put it at the bottom of the column. And they also have a term called nippering, which I love, is named after the pointy pliers that you cut metal with, that is for snipping parts of a budget that you didn't finish spending and moving it to another place to hide it so that you create a giant slush fund of money that can be spent in ways that nobody has a way of doing oversight on, if they ever did oversight.
I want you to talk also about this notion that there is what the Pentagon calls one-year money versus five-year money. Is that a real thing? And if so, is it legal to transfer money from one pot to another without a specific appropriation?
The Constitution actually says that no money can be spent by the government that is not appropriated for the purpose by Congress. So when Congress appropriates money for the Pentagon, they do it in a budget which says what it's going to be used for in each category. This much for the Army, this much for the Navy, this much for the Marines, this much for weapons procurement of, say, the F-35, and so on and so on. The one-year money is money that is for things that get spent in a year, you know, maintenance, contracts, building rents, salaries, and all of that. And five-year money is for things like weapons systems and, you know, large, long-term projects. And so what I was told by people who have worked in the Pentagon for years in accounting capacities is that there you can move little bits of money from one thing to another if they're related and if it's very small. I mean, under 1%, for instance, or 0.1%, I think it is, without, you know, permission from the congressional committees involved, the Armed Services Committees and the Budget Committees. But they're moving huger sums, I'm told, and it is illegal. There's a history for this. They did it in the 80s and got caught, and they did it in the 50s. But this is on a bigger, grander scale than what was done back then. In the 80s, they were overstating the inflation adjustment and adding like a 30% bonus for estimated inflation. And then when they didn't use it, it would get put into something called a merged surplus account. And that got up to almost $50 billion, which in today's money would be $100 billion pretty quickly, and was being used in unaccountable ways. And when Weinberger was asked about it, he said he couldn't locate the money.
Well, neither could Ernst & Young and a whole army of other accountants. I'm sorry to say that we're out of time. We were joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, as well as a columnist for Counterpunch. He's the author of this article in The Nation. It's an important article. Check it out. It's called The Pentagon's Massive Accounting Fraud Exposed. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said yesterday that the UK Integrity Initiative is a British government-sponsored front organization aimed at defaming the Russian government. The UK Integrity Initiative purported to be an independent watchdog organization until hackers from the group Anonymous found documents proving that it was instead created by British intelligence services. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. Welcome back, Jim.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for having me.
Jim, what do you make of this UK integrity project? What was the purpose of this thing before we realized that it was a government organization?
Well, it was promoted itself as countering the disinformation coming out of Russia, particularly, although it was also aimed at other countries, apparently, especially Greece. And, you know, they set up these little clusters, they call them, in various countries, in Europe especially. And it was very strange at the outset, even knowing it wasn't a government-funded organization. It was clearly an organization designed to promote Western propaganda or the Western line against Russia. So that's what it was. Now, we know that it was set up and funded by essentially British intelligence. It worked through the British embassies. You had to go to apparently go to an embassy and make an application to give me your resume as someone who would be capable of countering Russian disinformation. So, you know, it's kind of been clearly revealed for what it is, which is a semi-clandestine, not a clandestine, but clandestinely financed organization designed to promote Western propaganda.
Maybe the name isn't really that good. The Integrity Initiative.
It should be the Irony Initiative.
Yeah, the Irony Initiative. The truth is, this wasn't just about Russia. As Jim notes, there were other countries involved here too. Anonymous says that these documents that they have uncovered show that this Integrity Initiative included covert structures to interfere in domestic affairs of France, Germany, Italy, Greece, the Netherlands, Lithuania, Norway, Serbia, Spain, and Montenegro. This sounds like something from the CIA of the 1970s. It seems quite robust.
Yeah, sounds like an Operation Mockingbird.
Exactly right.
You know, more closely tied to the intelligence community in some respect, because it's really run out of the embassies, is what I saw. And, you know, setting up these inner cores of people, or these clusters of people who would be closely tied to this, is really kind of extraordinary that you see this. You know, again, one can't be shocked that this happens. This happens. And certainly would be completely, if it happened above board, if the British government and NATO said, we're going to have our propaganda operation and here it is, and because we think we're telling the truth and we want you to hear about it, then they should do that. But this is clearly a surreptitious way of pretending you're not tied to governments when you are, and when it's really entirely a government and NATO-funded thing.
People who want to know a little bit about the history of these kind of covert operations should just do some research about what's called the Cultural Cold War, what you were referring to, John. The United States government, through the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, surreptitiously created organizations just like this all over the world to counter the Soviet influence or socialist influence. It targeted communist parties. It targeted communist writers, communist cultural figures, and socialists. In other words, it was a full-blown, internationally financed covert operation. It was part of the soft power. And, you know, frankly, when you read the Washington Post or you read the New York Times, the arguments or the narrative rarely deviate from the narrative of the U.S. government, the same sort of narrative that would be promoted clandestinely through covert cultural interventions like this one. And of course, they're going to call their initiative something other than what it is. It's a clandestine operation. We're not going to call it America or British clandestine information to win you over in some sort of battle of ideas. So like the CIA in 1950 created the Congress for Cultural Freedom, and they financed jazz performances and theatrical performances, and they hosted conferences, and they brought actors and musicians and people of all kinds of influence, sports personalities all over the world, and it was a CIA operation. Again, people have to be aware of what's going on.
This has been going on for, as you say, decades. The Partisan Review, literary magazines, modern art movement was promoted by the CIA.
In fact, the CIA has an arts council internally, and this arts council curates paintings that the CIA acquired during that period.
Yes, yes, definitely Pollock and the modern art movement. The other thing that's interesting about this is important to say, I think, here is that they're now saying, oh, this is all about Russian interference in our elections, et cetera, et cetera. This organization was set up, I believe, in 2015. The Russian influence in elections didn't come up as an issue until after the election of 2016. So this wasn't set up about that. It was set up as a kind of offensive ideological strategy in relation, not just to Russia, as you say, but in order to promote NATO and Western and American and the British line in all of these countries, and to make sure that their policies that were taken in that countries were steered in the right direction.
Exactly. And again, be skeptical when you read materials.
Always.
Like, because everybody takes the news basically from the headline. They don't look, not everybody, but you know, the tendency is you look at a headline, you don't have time to read the article, you don't look for what the source is. It sounds good. It has the Integrity Initiative name. That's a soft, fuzzy, honest feeling, honest sounding name. when in fact it's clandestine operation. You know, again, just another example how this kind of cultural Cold War or narrative Cold War, the battle for ideas, goes on and on and on. During the Cold War, the Soviets always accused the United States of being perpetrators of racist apartheid-like policies at home, because the United States perpetrated racist apartheid-like policies at home. So it wasn't a hard case to make. So the U.S. government, using similar clandestine operations, supported and promoted Louis Armstrong.
Right.
And he went all over the world and all over Africa as like the spokesperson for U.S. foreign policy, because he was the most famous black jazz musician.
And actually was not permitted to stay in the ambassador's residence on that worldwide trip.
Amazing. Amazing. So they create this fiction. Look, we're not racist. We have Louis Armstrong. At the same time, the U.S. government, which was promoting this idea to do to be in competition with the socialist and communist narrative, the U.S. government wasn't willing actually to do significant efforts at home to undo the racist policies that the communist bloc was exposing, but instead just trying to camouflage it.
Yeah, and the Soviet propaganda at that moment was somehow some kind of disinformation or some kind of surreptitious, you know, thing to sow division. Again, this idea of we've got to prevent them sowing division. In other words, we've got to prevent them from telling the truth about the problems of American society rather than facing the problems of American society and doing something about them. And that's what's going on again, you know, and it's horrible.
I'd have to say it's been highly successful, too. And I think that's why the progressive movement actually has to make up its mind and take a stand and be strong about this. I know so many people who historically would have come to Answer Coalition anti-war demonstrations or other progressive activities who absolutely believe all parts of the Russiagate sort of narrative that Russia is doing this, that, and the other thing. And when I say to them, look, it could be a covert operation. It could be a disinformation, not just simply by intelligence agencies, but by political organizations, say like the Washington Post, which has a neocon foreign policy that's camouflaging their real foreign policy agenda, which is to build up animus and hostility towards Russia for other purposes, by convincing Americans that Russia is in fact undoing our democracy. When I tell people that, they kind of like, no, you're just gullible, or maybe because you have a show at Sputnik, you're compromised in some way. A lot of people absolutely believe this because it's been a very effective, comprehensive campaign.
And the line does really come. You can just see it from the top down, as you say. Is this a state-run media or not? I watched PBS the other day about this incident in the Gulf of Azov in the Kerch Strait, you know, and it was all Russian aggression. Russian seized Ukrainian boats. This is another example of Russian aggression after they annexed the Crimea. No context, absolutely upside down about what happened in this particular incident where, you know, these Ukrainian warships, you know, tried to enter against the rules that everybody had agreed upon. So no framework about that at all. It was like Georgia 2008 all over again. And this is crazy. It's, you know, clearly there's a line about this, and the establishment journalists don't deviate from it. They just won't.
You know, I was listening to Democracy Now, and, you know, Democracy Now has a lot of good stuff on it. I was listening to Democracy Now. One of the anchors said the other day when they were talking about the Sea of Azov crisis, when Russia invaded Crimea in 2014 as part of the thing, well, I mean, there was a referendum in Crimea. Majority of the population, which is Russian speaking, didn't want to stay in Ukraine. They wanted to reattach Crimea to Russia, which it was always had been part of Russia. Invasion of Crimea, just like just asserted by a progressive show host.
And this stuff that's come out about, you know, Manafort visited WikiLeaks, visited Assange, you know, all of these things come out. And there, so we know that there is and has been for 2-3 years, at least, an organization that was funded by the British government and NATO to try and put out lines through the media.
And that line about, we're going to end up here, John, but, you know, Assange being met with by Manafort. Manafort says 100% not true. WikiLeaks offered a bet of $1 million to The Guardian saying, of course, it's not true. But CNN and other mainstream media outlets kept running with the story even after The Guardian started to backtrack rapidly from the story because Luke Harding's so-called journalism isn't journalism, it's propaganda, and it's not true, or at least the principals say it's not true. They kept running with the story because it was already a headline.
It's already become part of the narrative.
Well, we're going to leave it there. We were joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.